Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. With case studies and in-depth conversations, we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. And in this episode, we'll be exploring dry eye and what to do if dry eye causes more bothersome or more serious symptoms in your patients. Severe dry eye or ocular surface disease can be tricky to manage well and may even require a referral to the hospital eye service. Later on, I'll be speaking to Professor Cy Colley, a consultant ophthalmic surgeon in Birmingham, about how he deals with ocular surface disease when it presents in his clinics. We'll also discuss how to potentially break the cycle of ocular surface damage early on in a primary care setting so that patients don't end up using overstretched hospital eye services.
People with severe dry eye have a marked reduction in their quality of life, similar to someone who's had a renal transplant or who's had unstable angina. So I personally think the best way to go is educating optometrists, because it's never going to be possible for all the dry patients that need treatment to be seen by an ophthalmologist.
Before that, one of our producers, Dr. Hilary Guyte, spoke to a patient to understand the wide-ranging impact of dry eye syndrome.
My name's Dave Cannell, and I work in technology with startups to help them grow, so sales and marketing.
When did you first notice something wrong with your eyes?
Well, I've had an unusually dry skin condition since birth called KFSD, keratosis follicularis spinulosis to Galvans. And then the way that shows up in my eyes is my Bowman gland dysfunction, and that led to quite severe and prolonged recurrent corneal erosions. Probably in school, I'd noticed sort of a lot of dryness. And then I remember early dates with my wife, and she'd wonder what I was doing as I dipped my finger in my peppermint tea and put it across my eyes. This is probably like mid-20s, not really seeing a specialist at the time. And then it was really probably late 20s, early 30s that I started to see specialists and things.
Was there something that made it suddenly worse that pushed you into going to see a specialist?
I noticed it turning up as I became involved in more stressful occupations. So as I led teams, I was actually in a startup that Google acquired. So bizarrely, I was then in this environment which was entirely air conditioned in their offices in London, no natural air. I think that was when I really started to find I couldn't really get through a day without ending up on the bed afterwards, as soon as I got back in from the office, just with pounding heads, pounding eyes.
Let's just go through all of those symptoms then. Just describe to me what a typical day would be like.
At this point, I hadn't had the recurrent corneal erosions. So I'm dealing with just a sense of very, very dry eyes that would create migraine feelings of headaches and, yeah, lots of pain in my eyeballs. But it really made a difference in terms of my career even then. I couldn't basically continue in that office. So although I had this exciting opportunity in my career, I had about 15 months there at Google and then had to look for alternative employment because there's just no way I could continue with the air conditioning.
And had you seen an optometrist by then?
I had. I'd seen someone in North London, and the first treatments I'd had of the sort of forced expression with the forceps around the eyelids to try and get the meibomian glands moving. Had a long and potted history with that treatment, but that was the first, I guess, treatment attempt to try and ease some of the discomfort.
When did things take a turn for the worse again?
We moved to Devon in 2015. I was commuting up and down to London from Devon for work, and it was 3 weeks after my first son was born. I actually was sat holding the baby, and about 11 o'clock at night, I suddenly felt this excruciating pain in my eyeball and rushed to A&E. And there followed probably about 2 or 3 months of being in and out of A&E at 4 in the mornings, 5 in the mornings, whenever this thing showed up. Having a variety of things from just being patched up with the gunk to big scleral lenses to protect the eye, to this retired doctor just taking a cocktail stick basically to my eyeball and just, doing lots of cocktail stick markings as a technique, I suppose, to get the epithelium to heal again. But in and out of hospital and trying to commute, trying to look at my screen through one eye to work and trying to look after my wife and baby. So, yeah.
And what impact did that have on your mental health at that time?
Well, I found, having made quite a big move in life and trying to get to know a whole new social scene down here, I found myself really stifled in social confidence because I would be in a room full of people I didn't know and then obviously only able to see out one eye. And it's quite incredible the difference in awareness and confidence you feel in that situation when you lose vision in one eye. But to the observer, to anyone else in the room, you look entirely normal and it's not detectable. So I felt very underconfident. I also felt like I'd let my wife down. And to be honest, it spiraled to a point where maybe about two and a half years ago, I was just crying, in the middle of the night and just saying to my wife, I can't go on. You know, I can't keep doing this. This is, it got to a pretty bleak pace. And fortunately, I've turned a corner since then, but it's had a very big impact, I think, on stress levels, anxiety levels, mental health, well-being. Yeah.
What do you wish you'd known going into this?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I wish someone could have just given me the recipe for what's helped 9 years ago. But actually, a lot of this treatment wasn't even available then. I guess I wish I'd known that it's a chronic condition, and that's something that takes a while to give into, the fact that this is something that's part of your genes and infected by environment and life, but ultimately it's a gene thing. So I guess just coming to terms with that and accepting that and making changes quicker to stabilise us.
Thank you very much for sharing all of that with us.
It's a pleasure. I hope it helps professionals out there.
David's story highlights the constant struggle that can result from dry eye conditions, both for a patient's ocular health and their mental health. In our last episode, called Patient Mental Health, Eyes and Minds, we spoke to Sarah Farrant, an optometrist who specialises in the intersection between dry eye and mental health. As it happens, Sarah is also David's optometrist, and she told me about how she manages these more serious cases of dry eye that need help. Hello, Sarah, and welcome back to Sound Optometry again.
Thanks, Michelle.
So, Sarah, we've just heard from your patient, David. How common are dry eye cases or stories like his?
David's case, obviously, is fairly extreme, but because I have a specialist clinic, patients like him sort of seek me out, as it were. So I see patients with his level of impact, both on their lifestyle and also the actual day-to-day managing the condition. But fortunately, the vast bulk of the patients in the clinic have less severe sort of manifestations with their dry eye disease.
So air conditioning seemed to be a major trigger for David when he got to that point where he felt he couldn't cope anymore and he was really struggling. So what are the other triggers or causes that we should be aware of?
The difficulty, I guess, about dry eye disease is that it is so very multifactorial. And the challenge as a practitioner is trying to understand what are the triggers in any one individual. And that often is really quite difficult to ascertain. So depending on if there are contact lens wearer, obviously, like, as you mentioned, environmental factors that aren't really the cause of the dry eye, but are the trigger that pushes the patient from a sort of comfortable enough state to a state where they're much more aware of the issue. And then you've got other issues like refractive surgery, systemic drugs such as beta blockers, antihistamines, that sort of thing, antidepressants, autoimmune diseases, Sjögren's syndrome, all of these things that are sort of feeding into the vicious cycle, as it were, that can trigger the problem.
And we see lots of patients with those kind of medications day in and day out. And of course, we see a lot of elderly patients as well. So is age a factor?
Age is most certainly a factor. I mean, the most commonly recognised issue is females over 40.
So when you're examining patients, what are the red flag signs and symptoms that you look out for?
I think one of the key things when you're examining a patient for dry eye disease is being methodical. So I will always use a specific sort of diagnostic workup. I want to know what their non-invasive tear breakup time is. I want to know what their osmolarity is. I want to know their tear prism height. I want to take a look at their meibomian gland functionality. I'm a bit of a fan of squeezing. In all honesty, I genuinely believe that you can't really diagnose a dry eye without squeezing and expressing the meibomian glands, because there are many, many examples, a decent percentage of patients that present with what I would call non-obvious MGD. So the mid margin looks pretty okay until you get a hold and squeeze the glands, and then the viscosity tells you a very different story. So even if you've got mibography and you're looking at the glands in infrared, that's really only half the picture. You need to be understanding what the glands are actually secreting to get a much better understanding of the severity and what you're really dealing with.
Or not secreting, as the case may be.
Indeed, yes.
Now, David actually mentioned a range of treatments that had mixed success. So what did eventually work for him?
Yeah, so for David, it was trying to sort of strip it back, because sometimes they're on so many treatments when they come in, you almost need to go, right, let's simplify here. Let's get it back to the bare bones and then almost begin that journey again and just get more selective about what we're going to use and utilize. So I know Dave mentioned that we used to do a lot of squeezing and expression because he had an awful lot of very viscous meibom in his glands and would find that expression would really help. And then in more recent years, he found that actually expression would seem to inflame the lids. He'd get a lot of edema and it just wasn't really doing what we were intending. So about maybe 3 years ago, we started using IPL, and that's been very successful.
Can you just explain what that is?
Yeah. So IPL, intense pulse light, is a form of light therapy. So we understand at the moment that the actual IPL part very likely cauterizes what we call telangiectasic vessels, which are the sort of dilated vessels on the lid margins and around meibomian glands that form due to chronic inflammation. So if we can cauterize those blood vessels, we can reduce the drivers to that inflammatory sort of cycle. We also know that IPL has an effect on Demodex. It kills Demodex. The iLight system that I use also has something called low-level light therapy or photobiomodulation. And that part, as we understand it, stimulates ATP, adenosine triphosphate production in the mitochondria in the cells. So it's actively stimulating the glands to function more normally. So IPL for David and low-level light therapy has proved to be very successful.
So obviously David is an extreme case. So when a practitioner sees dry eye or an ocular surface disorder that is beyond their normal scope of practice, what do they do next? How can they get their patient to the next level of treatment?
So I think in a way, a really good place to start is if as a practitioner, you're just interested in understanding what you do next. Resources like the TFOS Juice 2 articles are very informative and just trying to raise awareness of the options available, but also not forgetting that hopefully most ophthalmology departments have some sort of corneal specialism where they can support us as practitioners when it becomes significant. And patients like David, effectively I'm co-managing because the corneal specialists locally have also very much been involved in David's care. So we've accessed iCurvis for him on the NHS by getting the consultant to sign it off and just sort of working as a team and very much recognizing where the consultant will send him back to me for IPLs and hear more sort of stuff that I can easily do in my clinic. But then I've got him on hand when we get other issues that I need support with as well. So it's just understanding, A, the resources are out there and being willing to seek them out.
And if a patient isn't able to self-fund a private course of treatment or a private consultation, it would be really going through the GP into the NHS, wouldn't it, and seeing what was available through their local NHS eye hospital?
Absolutely.
Sarah, thank you very much.
No problem, Michelle. Thank you.
Next, we'll speak to Professor Cy Colley about the types of patients that end up in the hospital eye service for ocular surface disease and what we can do in primary care to try and prevent them from getting to that stage. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. So if you've got any suggestions or brilliant case studies that you think your colleagues would benefit from hearing, email us. The address is podcast@docket.info, or you can tweet us @soundoptometry. We've spent the first half of this podcast looking at dry eye and ocular surface disease management in optometric practice. But for some patients, their disease is advanced and they need to see a specialist ophthalmologist. One of these specialists is Professor Cy Colley. He's a consultant ophthalmic surgeon specialising in cataract, corneal and refractive surgery at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. Hello, Cy, and welcome to Sound Optometry.
Hello, Michelle, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
As a corneal specialist in hospital practice, what kind of cases do you eventually see in your clinics?
So typically in my NHS practice, Michelle, I would normally see patients who are pretty advanced along the spectrum of dry eye disease. So often these patients have been referred typically from one of my consultant colleagues or possibly by optometrists, but usually these patients have been seen for many months, if not years, in primary care, and then they're still having problems, symptoms, difficulties with their treatment.
So for those optometrists that are less experienced at dealing with dry eye, what are the key signs or symptoms that can help optometrists in their practices pick up on those cases that might need a little bit more help?
Well, I think, first of all, take a good history. You know, sometimes we have patients who perhaps have been treated with dry eye for a long time, not getting any better. And it turns out that possibly it wasn't dry eye. You know, there are lots of conditions which give rise to symptoms of foreign body sensation, burning, etc. But you need to exclude things such as, for example, allergic eye disease, sometimes uveitis. Being able to take a good history and do a thorough examination, that involves a full slit lamp examination, looking at the lids, the conjunctiva, the cornea, anterior chamber, etc., will allow you to separate dry eye from other conditions, because those other conditions need specific treatments. And so dry eye treatments may necessarily not help. Then when you have decided that this is dry eye, then before you launch into sort of eye drops specific treatments, it would be very important to look at what the causative factors of the dry eye. So typically patients may be on, for example, certain medications. They may be on other kinds of eye drops. They may be on certain tablets. Also, we see patients who've never had dry eye before, who through the COVID pandemic are suddenly having lots of symptoms of dry eye. And I think that, you know, you and I are communicating now via a screen. So typically, if I was talking to you in person, I might be blinking about 20 times plus a minute. And yet when I'm on a screen, that might be as little as 5 times a minute. So if you're not blinking for over 10 seconds and your tear breakup time is perhaps maybe, you know, reduced to 5 seconds, then you're really going to struggle. So, you know, taking these appropriate history, trying to find out, are there any exacerbating factors that we can control? Because if we can do that, then we can potentially minimise the amounts of drops, amounts of oral medications and subsequent treatments. So controlling the environment, controlling drugs and so on can go a great way in dealing with it.
So you mentioned like controlling the environment. What can people do, though? Because people will often say, well, I have to do this work. I can't reduce my hours. So what suggestions do you make?
So, you know, I think we're all possibly familiar with that 20-20-20 algorithm. Typically, if you are at a screen, every 20 minutes, just take a 20-second break, just looking away, focusing into the distance of the other 20 refers to 20 feet or 6 meters. The other thing I say is that, you know, when you're staring at a screen or you're typing away, it's quite difficult to ensure that you're blinking adequately. I mean, blinking is normally something that we don't actively think about, but I always tell my patients every time you hit the enter, do a blink. Other things that you can do, which are quite simple, is making sure that you're adequately hydrated, making sure that you drink plenty of water. Also making sure that the environment is relatively humid compared to what you're used to. So, you know, it's quite easy to get a humidifier that you can put in your room at home or even in your office that can help. So I think those simple things like that can go a long way to trying to minimise the sort of severity of the symptoms and make their subsequent management a bit easier.
And then going on from that, once you've decided that you've controlled those environmental factors as much as you can, and you're wanting to try some kind of treatment, where do you start?
So I think firstly, the most important thing is to try and assess the severity of the dry eye to start with, trying to be much more specific with these things. And questionnaires that we used to use a lot in research and in ophthalmology now are available online. You know, when we're looking at specific questionnaires, some of them are fairly complex. For example, the OSDI is fairly complex, but I think you're aware that there's an app that you can download where it's very easy. Just tap in the answers to the question and it will give you a score, or something like such as the DEQ5, again, is a very straightforward test that you can do. It's quite nice to have a baseline in which to look at and then institute treatments. And then obviously you're looking for clinical improvements, objective improvements, but also then repeating that questionnaire. We'll see if there's been some improvement in the symptoms felt by the patient.
So when conditions can't be managed in normal practice, and the condition does become quite severe, you then have to be more targeted in the next approach, don't you? So one of the practitioners I spoke to was Sarah, and Sarah's an advanced dry eye practitioner, and she actually mentioned a therapy that worked very well for one of her patients who was a chronic dry eye sufferer, and it was IPL. Is that something that is available in the hospital eye service?
At the moment, Michelle, unfortunately, IPL isn't available to NHS patients. I think you're absolutely right. In a proportion of patients, there seems to be a very good response to IPL. Interestingly, that's been used in dermatology for a long time. So it was used in the treatment of things such as rosacea and acne. And it was found that in these patients, when they used very intense light on the skin would clear up. But also patients who'd had previous dry, their dry was getting better, which is how we discovered that that worked. So unfortunately, at the moment, that treatment isn't available on the NHS. Although there are other ways of managing inflammation of the meibomian glands other than IPL, I would suggest that those other ways of managing inflammation should be looked at before IPL. So, for example, all those patients, it would be worth trying early on hot compressors. And when I say hot compressors, be very specific and didactic as to what you're telling the patient. You're ultimately trying to raise the temperature of the lid to about 40 degrees centigrade, which melts those secretions. And you can then massage the lids and remove those inflammatory secretions and clean the lids. And then also consider ways in which you can reduce inflammation on the surface. So you may want to use oral medications. There's evidence to suggest that increasing the amount of omega-3, omega-7, etc. can potentially benefit patients in terms of reducing the inflammation on the ocular surface. So again, those are things that can be used relatively easily and widely, and the downsides are very few.
For an optometrist that hasn't prescribed oral medication before for dry eye, what regime would you typically start someone on if they were going to try doxycycline?
So doxycycline is an antibiotic, and I would start a patient on about 50 milligrams once a day, and they would need to use that typically for a very long time. So I would say a minimum of 3 to 4 months, just to make sure that those patients obviously don't have an allergy to doxycycline, but also that there's no chance that they may be trying for a child or, you know, be breastfeeding, etc., because it's contraindicated in those situations. Also, it makes patients more sensitive to sunlight. And sometimes they get a bit of a stomach upset, but often if they take it for a little while, that settles down. But if they can't tolerate it, then it's easy enough to just stop.
So once you've started a patient on this and you're telling a patient that you probably need to try it for 3 to 4 months to see if it's going to be effective, is a patient likely to need to stay on doxycycline long term?
Yeah, I think that there are some patients who you'd seen them at 4 months, 6 months, and they'd had a profound improvement. Then it may be that you then suggest stopping it, or maybe continuing for a bit longer and then stopping it after a year or so, which happens in a significant number. If, however, they've had no benefits at all, then it may be that that's not having much of an effect, in which case it's not worth continuing with. The other common thing that you see is that they may be slightly better, but there's still a lot of inflammation there, and then you might have to then institute further treatments.
quite a lot of practitioners that I've spoken to, IP practitioners, have said that they quite like the drug Softacort, which is something that seems to be used for allergy and for dry eye. So can you tell the listeners a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so the underlying pathology in all dry eye is ocular surface inflammation. So what you want to do is try and decrease the inflammation on the surface. The easiest and quickest way to reduce inflammation anywhere in the body is with steroids. Steroids are brilliant at stopping inflammation. The problem is that, you know, obviously when you take oral steroids, tablet steroids, there's a whole plethora of side effects. In the eye, there's two main side effects. One is that a proportion of those patients will have elevated intraocular pressure leading to glaucoma, although that doesn't happen in everyone. The second complication you get with steroids, and this happens in everyone if you use them long enough, is that they form cataracts. So steroids are brilliant in the short term. So if you had someone who was really struggling with really a lot of inflammation on the surface of the eye, you know, thick soupy secretions, significant injection, sometimes you just need to knock it on the head and you would start with a steroid. Now, Softacort is a drug that's been relatively recently introduced and it has two great advantages for its use in dry eye. First of all, it's preservative free. Secondly, it contains hydrocortisone at a low dose. And the nice thing about it is that it doesn't tend to cause elevation in intraocular pressure because it doesn't absorb very much into the eye.
So you could start a patient's therapy with Softacort and get it under control and then maintain it with other methods once you've got that control. And if it can't be got under control or stronger steroids are indicated, then that's when referral into the NHS is needed.
Exactly, yeah. So steroids are for getting on top of the situation very quickly. If I had a patient who was only being controlled with high-dose steroids, then I would then consider them to use a steroid-sparing anti-inflammatory. So these are immunosuppressants. One immunosuppressant that we've used in medicine for a long time is cyclosporine. It turns out that topical cyclosporine can be very effective in preventing inflammation in the eye, but doesn't have all those side effects associated with oral cyclosporine. So, and interestingly, it's the only product that NICE has actually approved for dry eye treatment. So in those patients who have dry eye with inflammation, which is only steroid sensitive, and you've instituted all those other treatments that we've talked about already, then we would potentially start them on topical cyclosporine, and that can be very effective in a significant proportion of people.
So I guess what we've covered has been really useful because actually we're trying to identify patients at an earlier stage to try and prevent them from getting to that stage where they need to be referred into the NHS. There's certain things we can try before we refer them into the NHS. And actually when we do refer them, I suppose it's really important for us to detail in that referral a really good background as to, you know, what we've tried and what's worked and what hasn't worked so that you know exactly what's been done with the patient up to that point.
I think so. And if you're working in a practice which is predominantly maybe concentrating on refractions, issuing spectacles, etc., then you should know of who the optometric practices are in the area which have a special interest in dry eye. And then rather than thinking, oh, we'll just give them some form of drop just to see if it'll help, and probably best to just refer to those centres, and they're more likely to get more targeted and therefore more effective treatments.
That was great, Si. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle. It's been a pleasure.
Don't forget that if you go to the docit.info website and search for sound optometry, you can also find additional reading materials and resources that are relevant to this episode. By listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice and professionalism. We'll be back next month, following up on a Docit webinar to ask, are all optometrists clinical leaders? Until then, we'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen and like and subscribe to the series on your podcast app so you don't miss an episode. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.